Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. 2017 is supposed to be a banner year for walleye fishing in Lake Erie, but there are also threats. In 2014, a toxic algal bloom forced the shutdown of Toledo's drinking water system. It eventually reopened, but scientists continue to grapple with strategies to stem the now annual bloom on Lake Erie. The Asian carp, an invasive species that has been spotted in watersheds close to the Great Lakes, could eventually overtake Lake Erie, according to a recent study. And proposed cuts to the U.S. EPA and the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative could curtail work by scientists and conservationists to protect Lake Erie. Coming up, we'll hear from a charter fishing captain about what they're seeing and what they see as threats to Lake Erie. Joining us now is the director of Lake Erie Conservation for the Nature Conservancy of Ohio, Amy Brennan. Welcome, Amy.
Hello there. Thanks for having me.
And by phone as well, Extension Program Leader and Fisheries Educator at the Ohio Sea Grant Program, Tori Gabriel. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Tori, can you start off by explaining what the Ohio Sea Grant Program is and what it does and who funds it and if there are going to be cuts?
Sure. So we are one of 33 programs throughout the nation. Basically, every state with a coast has a Sea Grant program. Our federal funder is NOAA, and we focus on research, outreach, and education on whatever water resource we have. So in Ohio, obviously, we're focused on Lake Erie. We focus on healthy coastal ecosystems, sustainable fisheries, resilient communities and economies, and environmental literacy and workforce development.
So just from where you sit, when we hear 2017 is going to be a banner year for walleye on Lake Erie, are you looking at this year or are you looking at 2027?
We're looking at this year.
Okay.
Yes. Yep. So a couple years ago, there was a very big walleye hatch, one of the biggest since 2003. And that it takes about 2 years for those fish in Lake Erie to get big enough to be harvested. And so, yeah, we're expecting a big year this year, and then with another great hatch a year before or the year after that, we expect it to continue into next year as well.
Amy Brennan, the Lake Erie Conservation, you're Lake Erie Conservation Director at the Nature Conservancy of Ohio. When you look at Lake Erie right now, are you considering what's happening right now? Obviously, celebrating this, you know, this hatch. It's going to be a good year for fishermen on the lake this year. But what about going forward?
Yeah, we're definitely looking at the future with Lake Erie, and a lot of the fisheries work really does tie back to what's the water quality in the lake. And the Lake Erie is the most productive of the Great Lakes, and most estimates say that about half the fish in all of the Great Lakes are actually in Lake Erie.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's definitely the most productive. We only have about 2% of the water, about half the fish. And looking at how Lake Erie is such a productive fishery is linked to a lot of these issues that also cause our algal blooms. We have a lot of productivity in Lake Erie, and we want to keep that balanced with the amount of nutrient loading that's coming into the lake and our algal blooms, because the algal blooms and the water quality problems associated with those can also impact the fisheries population, and they certainly impact our recreational opportunities and our enjoyment of actually being able to go out and go walleye fishing.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about fishing on Lake Erie, and you can't do that without talking about the environment of Lake Erie. You just heard from Amy Brennan. She's Lake Erie Conservation Director at the Nature Conservancy of Ohio. Also with us, Tori Gabriel. He's the Extension Program Leader and Fisheries Educator for the Ohio Sea Grant College Program at Ohio State University. Tori Gabriel, how would potential cuts to the Environmental Protections Agency impact work done through the Ohio Sea Grant Program?
It would have some effect for sure, but directly through the EPA, it would be more of a side effect for us. We don't get a lot of funding directly from the EPA. We have applied for some outside grants in the past, and some of our individual extension agents have received some funding for that. But directly to Ohio Sea Grant, that wouldn't be a huge deal for us. Now, that would obviously be a huge deal for the lake, but not for us.
Well, if it's a huge deal for the lake, how does that? Is that what you mean, sort of an indirect impact on what you do?
Yes. Yep, absolutely.
How would it change it?
Well, that's certainly up for debate, but okay. Imagine any less funding going into the lake is going to be less opportunity for us to clean it up even more than it is now and sustain the great parts of it that Amy just talked about a little bit ago.
How do the algal blooms affect fish populations in the lake? I mean, at a certain level, it's nutrients that the fish consume, right?
Correct. There's a lot of research going on to that right now. We're actually funding some work going into how algal turbidity affects fish vision. So things like walleyes are very visual predators.
Okay.
Things like emerald shiners are their prey, and they rely on their eyesight too. So not just because of the toxins on the fish, which we don't really think that has a huge effect on them so far. We haven't found that. But the turbidity could just bring a whole different side of things that people haven't really thought about yet. So studying how that affects their behavior, their ability to forage, where they hang out. Is it going to be harder to find them? Do you have to move out of the blooms to catch these fish? So there's a lot of work going into how exactly that will affect them.
But yeah, I think it was you or Amy said that the good prospects for 2017 when it comes to walleye in Lake Erie is a function of a hatch from 2 years ago. Wasn't that just the year after that big bloom that shut down the water system in Toledo?
Yeah. So Lake Erie's a massive system, right? It is, by far, as Amy said, 2% of the water in the Great Lakes, so we're a puddle compared to the other four Great Lakes, but we're still a massive body of water, and all the Great Lakes are connected. And so it's this massive system with tons of effects. So to pinpoint that the fish hatch in relation to the algal blooms is really impossible to do. There's a lot of other effects going into that. But she's absolutely right. The productivity of Lake Erie depends on a big base of good green algae. Now that's separate from this toxic algae, the cyanobacteria, the harmful algae that we talk about. So,
which largely is caused by watershed run out from the watershed from the farms, right, Amy?
Absolutely. The work that's been happening over the past few years, and certainly was ramped up, I think, after the Toledo water crisis, is looking at what are the relative sources of the nutrient loading to Lake Erie. And a large portion of that is coming from our agricultural areas. And that's also because the agricultural areas are also 70% of the landscape. So there's a huge amount of agricultural production that happens within the Western Lake Erie Basin. And we now know that the target we're looking at to try to reduce the amount of primarily phosphorus loading to Lake Erie, that target's a 40% reduction. And that reduction is going to come through a number of different sources. Certainly, there's going to be work that needs to be done in the agricultural sector, not just on limiting the amount of nutrients that we're putting on our fields, but also making sure they stay in the field so they can grow our crops rather than growing algae out in Lake Erie. And we also know that we've got a lot of work yet to do in our urban areas. We still have over four combined sewer overflows within the Western Lake Erie, within the Lake Erie watershed just in Ohio. And those are all in process of being fixed, but many of them are in a 20 and 30 year time frame to actually be able to complete that work and be able to reduce that nutrient loading to the lake.
When you say overflows from the urban areas, are you talking about like Cleveland, Toledo, that kind of a thing?
Certainly, Cleveland area is one of the larger combined sewer overflows, but also as you go further up in the watershed, there's a lot of small communities, Defiance, Bucyrus, Tiffin, that also have these older systems that were developed to manage our sewage and our stormwater, that all of that water was combined in one system. And when we get excessive rainfall, we get overflows of those systems, which effectively results in raw sewage going into our streams and into the lake. But it's not just those combined sewer overflows that are right on the lake shore. There's also most of those are actually further up in the watershed.
So you said they're on fixing them are on 20, 30 year timelines. How much of that is dependent on federal funding and on federal attention to that?
Quite a bit of federal funding does come to address those issues, as well as local utility fees and wastewater treatment plant fees. But a lot of times those local fees are actually leveraging additional investment from federal funding sources. So looking at those opportunities for funding sources like the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, which has funded a huge range of restoration and research activities. Ohio alone has had $165 million of investment from the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative in doing a lot of work that is not just dealing with the hardcore infrastructure like combined sewer overflows, but also being able to restore some of those natural features back in the landscape, such as wetlands and floodplains, those areas that can help capture and store some of that water, treat some of that before it goes downstream, before it gets to Lake Erie, and be able to add not only opportunities for treatment, but also opportunities for recreation and for natural areas that can be multi-use. They can actually be a part of our nutrient solution as well as part of our recreational opportunities.
Tori Gabriel, before we move on, I wanted to talk a little bit more about fish, and in particular, the invasive fish species, Asian carp. It has not yet hit the the Great Lakes per se, but it's expected for sure. What are your expectations? What does a species like the Asian carp do to a place like Lake Erie? What could it do?
Well, so first off, the Asian carp is often, as you said, cited as a species. It's actually not. When you hear Asian carp in the news, that's four different species they're okay. talking about. There's a black carp that eats mollusks, and it's farther away. It's the least concern right now. There's the silver carp that jumps. There's the big head carp. Both of those species eat phytoplankton. So they filter feed on plankton, which is the bottom of the Lake Erie food chain, which we already discussed is vital for us to have anything else living in Lake Erie. So those are really the ones people are most concerned about. But then the fourth species is grass carp. And unfortunately, we have found grass carp in Lake Erie, multiple grass carp, and we've even found a couple instances of grass carp spawning in Lake Erie. Not in Lake Erie proper, but in the Sandusky River.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem with grass carp is they eat vegetation, and so those wetlands that Amy was just talking about could be vulnerable to those species if they were to become established in the lake.
And this is kind of going on up around Lake Michigan or down by this. They're supposed to be coming in around Illinois, Chicago area. Is that what the deal is?
So those would be the big head and the silver carp.
The jumping and yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And so yes, the one of the more likely areas for them to come in is through the Chicago area waterway system, which would be in the southern part of Lake Michigan. And so from there, it would take them years most likely to get around to Lake Erie. But there are other ways. They are in the Ohio River. Now, that's a distinct watershed, obviously, from Lake Erie in mm-hmm. Ohio, but there is a potential for them to transfer even closer than Chicago. The Division of Wildlife in Ohio is working really hard to close any potential areas that might happen. But if they were to get into, especially the western basin of Lake Erie that is so productive, they would essentially be 40-pound zebra mussels. Zebra mussels were a big problem because they sucked up that phytoplankton from the bottom of the food chain. And a similar thing could happen if you got those large big head and silver carp in the western basin of Lake Erie.
By the way, we invited the Ohio Department of Natural Resources to join the conversation. They said that they couldn't find an appropriate guest. We will continue our conversation about fish in Lake Erie. The season approaches. It's supposed to be a banner year, but is there anything that we could talk about today that could foreshadow years in the future? That's what we're talking about. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. This hour, we're talking about fish and the part they play in the overall health of the Lake Erie ecosystem. According to a 2015 study from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Great Lakes Environmental Research Laboratory, invasive species such as the four varieties of Asian carp could gain a foothold in Lake Erie, and their impact would be dramatic. It could lead to a sharp decline in sport fish such as walleye and rainbow trout. We invited the Ohio Department of Natural Resources to join the conversation. They said that they couldn't find an appropriate guest. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers was set to release a report on how to deal with the invasive species problem, but that effort has been indefinitely delayed by the Trump administration. We're going to talk about that right now. Still with us, Extension Program Leader and Fisheries Educator at the Ohio Sea Grant Program, Tori Gabriel, and also with us, Director of Lake Erie Conservation from the Nature Conservancy of Ohio, Amy Brennan. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So I don't know which of you wants to talk first, but the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers was set to release that report on how to deal with the Asian carp situation. It's been indefinitely delayed under the Trump administration. What were you hoping to see in the Corps plan, Tori Gabriel?
There's that connection in Chicago. Really, they're trying to figure out the best way to stop carp from coming through there. The problem is you can't just fill it in because there is a lot of commerce that goes through that canal system, as well as it's the sanitary and shipping canal for the area. So it's unfortunately a little more complicated. Naturally, it was a separate watershed, and that would obviously be the best answer, is really to cut that off physically with a physical barrier. But again, there's a lot of people that depend on that. And so that's why this has been such a difficult thing to do.
Amy Brennan?
I think what we were hoping to see from this report was, first and foremost, the report that we could respond to and actually give some comments back on. There's been a good amount of research and looking at a multitude of different options, locations in which to put physical barriers, electric barriers, chemical barriers. And I, one of the things that we've really been looking at the Nature Conservancy is the need to have a barrier that works both ways, because this artificial connection has allowed not only the opportunity for species that are in the Mississippi drainage to get up through the river system and into the Great Lakes, but it also allows things like zebra mussels to have come from the Great Lakes down into the Mississippi River system. So it is a two-way connection, and we really have been looking for or hoping that we will see that this two-way problem gets a two-way solution. And I think the research that we've looked at and that we've been engaged in is really looking at chemical treatment is the way to do that two-way connection. What we were anticipating we were likely to see from the Corps is more of a barrier system that would have actually only been effective one way.
So what's they've indefinitely delayed this in the Trump administration. Do either of you know why?
This is Tori. I do not know why. But
was it
this is
go ahead.
This is something that's been really delayed for quite some time, or at least drawn out. So we've known about this connection for as long as I've been an Ohio Sea Grant, which is 10 years now going on. And so this has taken a long time anyways. So I'm not sure, maybe it's me being a little bit cynical, but I'm not sure delaying it is gonna affect a whole lot. It's already been delayed a lot. So we know there's a lot of work that needs to be done on it. I guess having it come out, like Amy said, would have been great, because then it could have gotten comments back and then hopefully gotten something on the ground and moving. But that needs to happen regardless.
Yeah, and Amy Brennan, I mean, how much time do we have to play with when it comes to these Asian carp?
Well, I think, as Tori mentioned, we're already seeing one of those four species, the grass carp, actually already in Lake Erie. And there has been some DNA evidence that there are potentially small numbers of silver and bighead carp in Lake Michigan. And so I don't know that we have a discrete answer to say exactly, you know, what is the moment in time where we're going to see this be a problem, but we know that these species will thrive in Lake Erie, that they will outcompete a lot of our native species, and that they will be an enormous problem for us. So we feel that being prudent and being proactive in actually addressing these issues is critically important, and certainly the longer we wait, the more opportunity we have for those species to come through one of the several channels that are out there as potential connection areas between the Great Lakes and the Mississippi drainage.
I remember, you know, when the emergence of the zebra mussel and what a big deal that was at the time. Tory Gabriel, how did they do in managing the zebra mussel, or did it just do what it was going to do and everything else, you know, just learn to adapt to it?
Yeah, unfortunately, it was the latter. So yeah. Most invasive species, when they get into a new system, are impossible to, or not impossible to manage, but are very difficult. And if they are possible to manage, it's expensive, like the sea lamprey, for instance. We still have them. They're being pretty well managed throughout the Great Lakes system, but that costs millions and millions of dollars annually to treat the rivers to make sure that population stays low. So zebra mussels, there really isn't that answer. Again, Lake Erie is a giant system. There are some things coming out to treat zebra mussels in small areas, cooling water intake ponds and things like that, but those are not effective in a big system like Lake Erie. So they moved in. They were actually outcompeted by a very similar invasive species called a quagga mussel in Lake Erie. So they're mostly gone. Zebras are mostly gone from Lake Erie. The quaggas have mostly taken over. But they do the same thing. So again, they filter feed off of that bottom of the food chain, taking the food away from everything else, really redistributing the entire food web to be more towards the bottom of the lake. And as you said, the native species just kind of had to adapt to that.
So, you know, I go back again to the walleye issue. How much was that anticipated it would affect the walleye in Lake Erie, you know, 20 years ago? Tory?
I was not doing Lake Erie science 20 years ago, yeah. Unfortunately, so I can't give you a firsthand experience of what it was projected to do to the walleye.
Uh-huh.
But it probably has had some effect. Again, by redistributing that food web and taking that plankton down, it's taken the food from the shiners, and that's what the walleyes eat. So it really just has probably had to change their behavior a little bit and how they forage and where they forage. We still have a vibrant walleye fishery, so it hasn't eliminated that. But I'm not sure that was ever what the fear was.
We're talking about fish in Lake Erie. Coming up, we're going to hear from the president of the Lake Erie Charter Boat Association on what is supposed to be a banner year, but also what they're looking and worrying and concerned about looking for beyond 2017. We're talking with Tory Gabriel. He's fisheries educator he's extension program leader and fisheries educator for the Ohio Sea Grant College program at OSU. Also with us, Amy Brennan, Lake Erie Conservation Director at the Nature Conservancy of Ohio. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And one other question just about the fish, Tory Gabriel. We always hear about walleye in Lake Erie. What other sorts of sports fishing is there in Lake Erie?
Well, there's a lot. So walleye is probably the number one. Close number two would be yellow perch, because they are abundant. They're relatively easy to catch, and they are delicious. Number three would either be steelhead, which is actually a non-native fish, so it's not invasive, but it's something that's put into the tributaries of Lake Erie as a sport fish, so it can get out to the main lake. And then also the black basses is what they're called. So smallmouth bass has been the dominant black bass in Lake Erie for forever, but recently that's been matched by largemouth bass because of changing conditions, more vegetation, that's more habitat for largemouth bass.
Changing conditions, changing habitat. Amy Brennan, I mean, part of this is natural, right? Things change.
Part of it's natural, sure, and part of historically the Lake Erie fisheries have been impacted by what we eat from the Great Lakes and how we've managed that resource. When you look at what Lake Erie, it's difficult to compare Lake Erie to any other fishery because it's such a robust fishery. But when you look at what that fishery would have looked like at the turn of the 20th century and looking at species such as sturgeon, which we don't really see in Lake Erie anymore that was largely lost because of overfishing and dams on tributaries. When we look at things like Lake Herring and Lake Whitefish, there's still some remnant populations of those species in Lake Erie, but those would have been tens of millions of pounds being harvested every year. We also saw a lot of decline in species like northern pike, which would have been an enormous recreational and commercial fishery, but they largely used our coastal wetlands as their primary breeding habitat. So when we impacted some of those wetlands, we impacted what those fish populations look like. And I think when we always focus with Lake Erie on our walleye and our yellow perch, because those are the big tasty ones that we like to eat a lot. And when we start to look at what the lake would have looked like historically, it raises some other questions about what should some of our restoration strategies be, and are there opportunities to bring some of these other species back, to actually look at bringing back sturgeon and lake whitefish and lake trout and more robust northern pike populations. Those are all opportunities that we're really only beginning to explore those discussions.
Tori Gabriel, why does Lake Erie produce so many more fish than the other Great Lakes? What's happened to the rest of them?
Nothing's happened to the rest of them. They're oligotrophic, which just means they're deeper. They're a lot deeper. They're colder. And so they do not have that productivity that that bottom base of phytoplankton that Lake Erie has. So because we're situated, we're more southern than the rest of the lakes. We're smaller. So I like to say, if you have a glass full of water and a glass half full of water and set them both out in the sun, the half full one's going to warm up quicker. Same thing happens in Lake Erie. So that warmer condition just allows more things to grow. And that thing happens to be the bottom of the food chain in Lake Erie.
There is concern that plans to curb invasive species would be a burden, would burden the shipping in the Great Lakes. What is the controversy there, Tori Gabriel?
Sorry, could you repeat that question?
The impact on shipping in the Great Lakes, another big industry.
Yeah, yep. So a lot of the invasive species that are in the Great Lakes, unfortunately, got here through ballast water, which some ships that come from across the ocean take on to make themselves sturdy as they come across. In the past, it just wasn't thought about, and I'm talking decades and decades ago, that water from other freshwater ports across the ocean could actually be carrying species that would thrive in our freshwater ports. So that's how things like the zebra mussel got here. Since then, they've enforce some regulations like swishing those ballast water tanks, which are gigantic, so it's not an easy thing to do, but swishing them out with salt water before they come into the Great Lakes, effectively killing most of the species that would be in there. That's just one example of increased potential regulations that would have to be put on the shipping industry to help combat that. But also, back to the Chicago area waterway system where the Asian carps are coming in or potentially coming in, that shipping industry would take a hit there as well. And that's really probably the current most controversial.
Why would it take a hit?
Because those physical barriers that would
the
most effective would just block them from doing their jobs, basically. Or at least force them to transfer. Instead of shipping, they'd have to transfer to rail car or truck, and that would be much less efficient and burn a lot more fossil fuels. So there are positives and negatives to both decisions. But
Amy Brennan, are there other stakeholders that I'm not mentioning right now when it comes to conserving Lake Erie in what you do?
Certainly. There's a whole suite of public, private partnerships that are working on issues around Lake Erie, everywhere from the farmer who's doing a better job of managing the nutrients on this field to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Ohio Department of Natural Resources that are restoring wetlands along the coastline. I think that what's been so interesting with any of the projects we've been engaged with that have been funded through the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative is that there's a suite of partners on every single one of those projects. We're never in going through this endeavor alone. We're bringing in researchers such as Tori to help us look at the success of our wetland restorations and see what fish are actually using those wetlands post-restoration. We're working with our partners in the agricultural community and agribusiness on testing out new strategies to better manage the nutrients in the agricultural areas. So there's an enormous number of groups and different types of skill sets and different backgrounds that are coming to address things in Lake Erie. And I think that's exactly what we need, is that all hands on deck approach to really being able to restore and protect Lake Erie.
Aaron in Mansfield, you're on the air. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is if one of your specialists could answer, why does Lake Erie seem not to be freezing as often, as far out from the shore and as thick of ice as it had in the past? I appreciate your taking my call, and I'll take the answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay. Tori Gabriel, can you answer that?
Yeah, it's just been warmer. I know that's a very simplistic answer, but just the parts that we're seeing it with climate change, it's been warmer. That makes the water a lot warmer. So it takes it a lot longer to freeze, and we just haven't had those conditions in several of the past years to freeze.
Is that good for fish in Lake Erie?
Actually, there's some anecdotal evidence that says it's not good for fish. So when we have had long, hard freezes and constant ice over a long period of time, we have tended to see better hatches of walleyes, for instance, in those years. Now, that's not a direct correlation. That's not every time. So it's probably more an effect of that ice provides some protection from weather events. Mm. Maybe it holds off the hatching of the larval walleye. If spawning is later, maybe the hatch occurs when their phytoplankton food is more readily available, so they can actually eat more quicker and then are more able to survive. But it actually turns out that long, hard winters are probably better for fish than the other way around.
Yeah, Amy Brennan, thoughts about climate change?
Well, we've certainly are seeing the impacts of that. As Tori mentioned, we've had warmer weathers. We've had shorter bouts of very cold weather. So even on occasion when Lake Erie has gotten a significant amount of ice coverage, we get days where it warms up and we actually get some of that ice getting broken up, and we have Lake Erie more open water again. The other thing that we have already seen is that we are having more frequent and more intense storm events, which makes all of our runoff problems into Lake Erie more challenging to deal with. We've seen about a 10% increase in the severity and magnitude of severe storms. And those are those rain events when we get 3 or 4 inches of rain in a 20 or 30 minute period. And there's no structures, whether in the urban area or in our agricultural areas, that are currently designed to deal with that very effectively. So that makes our nutrient runoff and our pollutant runoff issues much more challenging.
Amy Brennan, we have to bid you farewell. I want to thank you for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Amy Brennan, Lake Erie Conservation Director at the Nature Conservancy of Ohio. Coming up, we're going to hear from the president of the Lake Erie Charter Boat Association. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Thank you. Welcome to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about fish and the role they play in the overall health of the Lake Erie ecosystem. Beyond the environmental impact of algal blooms and invasive species, there is a serious economic impact when lake conditions are weakened. Hundreds of millions of tourism dollars are at stake. Still with us is Extension Program Leader and Fisheries Educator at the Ohio Sea Grant Program, Tori Gabriel. Tori, thanks again for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Joining us now by phone is President of the Lake Erie Charter Boat Association, Captain Paul Pacholski. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Ed.
Tell us about what, from where you sit, what you've seen in terms of the impact that toxic algal blooms and their, you know, have on sport fishing in Lake Erie.
Well, on the years that we have a heavy bloom, now understand we don't have a heavy bloom every year, according to rate. But on the years we have a heavy bloom, you'll see that's up to a 25% drop in business. And the Lake Erie sport fishing business, just in the eight counties in Ohio, is $1.3 billion. So that's a significant amount of money.
Why does it drop? Just because people don't want to go out fishing with a bunch of green goop all over the place?
Well, that's part of it. People hear the microcystin, which isn't just green goop. It's actually a very hazardous material when producing the microcystin. But it also seems to change fish patterns and bait patterns. When the smaller fish move, the bigger fish tend to go with it.
Do we know why that happens, Tori Gabriel?
Why, which part of that?
Why happens? It changes fish patterns and bait patterns?
Just as Paul alluded to, they're really, well, earlier I referenced the study about how it affects their vision. And these turbidity is what we call it. So it's basically getting cloudy, and it's this green cloudiness. And so really we're looking at right now if that affects where those forage fish go. And then, as Paul said, wherever those forage fish go, your bigger fish are going to follow because that's their food. So really it's just focusing on how it affects those bait fish.
Paul Pacholski, when did the blooms start to affect business?
Well, we first noticed the blooms in 2003. But I would say around 2011, it started to get some notoriety, and people started to realize it was a harmful algal bloom. And what really triggered it was the water shutdown in the city of Toledo that affected a 500,000 people.
That's when people really started to notice, really around the world, right?
Right, right. We had people coming in that we took on boat tours that were coming in to the University of Michigan, no offense there, Tori. They were coming from South Korea. They were coming from all over the world to see what our reactions, how we were treating it. Because this is not just a localized problem. This is not Lake Erie's problem. This is not the Great Lakes or Big West. It's the whole United States, and it's also the whole world's problem.
Right, the conditions that are creating these blooms are happening all over the place.
Correct.
Yeah, and so when you talk about a 25% drop in a $1.3 billion industry that affects eight counties, that's really huge. What's the difference in the impact on the commercial fishing industry and the recreational fishing industry, Paul Pacholski?
I don't believe there's much of a influence. Tori might know something that I don't, but Central Basin, let's explain. The commercial fishery in the U.S. is only a perch fishery. And where the algal blooms focus is mainly in the Western Basin. So when the commercial fishermen in Ohio or the U.S. commercial fishermen fish, they're moving to past Cleveland towards Conneaut, Ashtabula, where because of a lot more volume of water, the algal bloom isn't very significant, and they're still able to catch their perch. How it affects the Western Basin anglers in Canada, I really don't know. They fish with gill nets and versus trap nets in Ohio.
Tori Gabriel, how much does the U.S., how much does Ohio work with Canada on these issues?
So that's where it would be nice to have your representative from the Division of Wildlife. But they work very well on the fisheries issue specifically. So there's the Great Lakes Fishery Commission, and there's a Lake Erie Committee within that. And so not just Ohio and Ontario, but also scientists from Michigan and Pennsylvania, New York as well, all share data and all focus on all of these issues because we recognize it as a lake-wide issue, right? The water doesn't pay attention to state and the political boundaries.
Right.
So very well, actually.
My guest, Captain Paul Pachowski, he's president of the Lake Erie Charter Boat Association, also Tori Gabriel from the Ohio Sea Grant College Program at OSU. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Now, they say, Paul Pachowski, that it's going to be a banner year. What does that mean to you? I mean, is that a guaranteed banner year or is it a potential banner year?
I'll go with potential banner year. Fishing is just like any other sports activity. It is driven a lot by the weather. Now, as far as water quality, that's all based on time of the year of substantial rainfalls. If you have heavy rainfalls in April and May and early June, followed by warm, sunny temperatures, you're going to have a major algal bloom. If you have normal, which I'm not quite sure what that word means anymore, but if you have more normal rainfalls, less than, say, an inch in 24 hours in a week, then you'll have a very minor algal bloom. But the other major factor that drives fish is temperature. And as the temperature of the water, it's not unusual to see the western basin of Lake Erie being the shallowest and southernmost of all the Great Lakes, get up to a temperature in the low to mid-80s. And fish, especially walleyes, are very temperature sensitive. And that temperature can drive them to the deeper, cooler waters that is east in the central and eastern basin.
What's Tori Gabriel, what's the sweet spot when it comes to temperature of the lake for walleye?
Oh, it depends on where you're at.
Okay.
That's probably a better question for Paul.
Okay. Paul Pachowski?
Okay, well, we find that 75 is just a 70 to 75 is a real sweet spot for us. According to the DNR, they say that after 75 degrees water temperature, now it varies from surface to bottom, of course, but after 75, the fish get more lethargic. And as it approaches 78, they only feed for substance, not for growth. So your feeding window gets less.
So when you're talking about a lethargic fish, you're talking about a fish that's not as interested in the bait and your hook.
Right. That's
okay. Okay. When I get lethargic, I eat more. So, the Ohio Department of Natural Resources. Well, sorry, switching gears here. What are charter boat captains and others in the fishing industry saying about the threat of the Asian carp species and other invasive species? Paul Pachowski.
Well, we're going to constant meetings. In fact, my partner, Dave Spangler, who's my vice president, and I, along with several others from all the Great Lakes, are going to next year. I mean, this week, actually, Wednesday and Thursday. And we will be petitioning the Senate and the House for both Great Lakes restoration money that looks like it might be mightily cut, along keeping our U.S. EPA strong, and fighting the Asian carp out of Chicago, especially the Ballville Dam project. That is paramount to us. And all three of those issues have kind of been put on the back burner as of late.
Well, what is your sense about how interested federal lawmakers are in your concerns?
As far as we have been going, this will be our eighth visit to Washington, and we have been extremely well received. Our Senators Portman and Brown in this area are collaborating mightily on this issue, and their co-chairs. And I've never seen cooperation on both sides of the aisle. There's not much that Democrats and Republicans agree on except the health of the lake.
Tori Gabriel, in general, how does the there's the issue of overfishing. I can't remember if it was you or Amy Brennan that brought that up, but are there regulations? How do they manage overfishing and avoid it on Lake Erie?
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of regulations. They do vary a little bit from state to state. But again, the Lake Erie Committee that I mentioned earlier, basically they come together, biologists from all the states, and with their data say this is how many fish of whichever species they're focused on at the time. This is how many we can take from Lake Erie without negatively affecting the population. And then that gets divvied up based on how much water area each state or province has. And then that gets divvied up further by those individual states. So in Ohio, you have a 6 limit per person per day limit on walleye. So if I go out on Paul's boat with 5 friends, we can only keep 6 walleyes a person.
A person. Okay. Okay.
Yep.
Not between you. And Paul Pachelski, I mean, is there necessarily a divide over those regulations?
No, absolutely not. In fact, what Tori's talking about is what's called the TAC, which is total allowable catch. That was derived at a combination of the Department of Natural Resources of both Ohio and Canada, the sport and commercial fishermen all sitting down, looking at populations, looking at replenishment of the lake and the carrying capacity. And with all of our agreement, we arrived at this, and to everybody's credit, whether it's commercial or sport fishermen, I think we erred on the side of conservation, so that actually more fish could have been taken, but we would rather see a stronger stock for more recruitment. And right now, I don't know if you covered this earlier, but right now, we are sitting at perpetually some of the highest numbers of walleye and yellow perch in the Western Basin since 2005.
Right. We did. I mean, that's sort of the kind of what gave me the idea to even do this show in the first place, given all of the other news out there, the politics and the environment. What are you looking at for the catch limit then this year? What are you expecting?
Oh, it'll be the same.
Okay.
We really don't want catch limits. You know, it's not like a commercial fishery. When the fishing is really good, you get more people going out catching fish.
Okay.
Without raising the limit, you're taking more fish. When fishing's really kind of poor, you got less anglers, less effort, and less harvest.
Okay. Captain Paul Pachelski, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your help today.
Oh, my pleasure.
It's Captain Paul Pachelski. He's president of the Lake Erie Charter Boat Association. It's supposed to be a banner year for walleye on Lake Erie. And Tori Gabriel, thanks to you as well for joining us this hour.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
Tori Gabriel is the Extension Program Leader and Fisheries Educator for the Ohio Sea Grant College Program at Ohio State University. Thanks a lot for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.